Chapter 23. Sense farther enlarged, in the course of the afternoon, by the receipt of a telegram from Selden asking if he might dine with her that evening. While Jerdy was lost in the happy bustle which this announcement produced in her small household, Selden was at one with her in thinking with intensity of Lily Bart. The case which had called him to Albany was not complicated enough to absorb all his attention, and he had the professional faculty of keeping a part of his mind free when its services were not needed. This part, which at the moment seemed dangerously like the whole, was filled to the brim with the sensations of the previous evening. Selden understood the symptoms. He recognized the fact that he was paying up, as there had always been a chance of his having to pay up for the voluntary exclusions of his past. He had meant to keep free from permanent ties, not from any poverty of feeling, but because, in a different way, he was, as much as Lily, the victim of his environment. There had been a germ of truth in his declaration to Jerdy Farish that he had never wanted to marry a nice girl. The adjective connoting, in his cousin's vocabulary, certain utilitarian qualities which are apt to preclude the luxury of charm. Now it had been Selden's fate to have a charming mother. Her graceful portrait, all smiles and cashmere, still emitted a faded scent of the undefinable quality. His father was the kind of man who delights in a charming woman, who quotes her, stimulates her, and keeps her perennially charming. Neither one of the couple cared for money, but their disdain of it took the form of always spending a little more than was prudent. If their house was shabby, it was exquisitely kept. If there were good books on the shelves, there were also good dishes on the table. Selden Sr. had an eye for a picture, his wife an understanding of old lace, and both were so conscious of restraint and discrimination in buying that they never quite knew how it was that the bills mounted up. Though many of Selden's friends would have called his parents poor, he had grown up in an atmosphere where restricted means were felt only as a check on aimless profusion, where the few possessions were so good that their rarity gave them a merited relief, and abstinence was combined with elegance in a way exemplified by Mrs. Selden's knack of wearing her old velvet as if it were new. A man has the advantage of being delivered early from the home point of view, and before Selden left college he had learned that there are as many different ways of going without money as of spending it. Unfortunately, he found no way as agreeable as that practiced at home, and his views of womankind in especial were tinged by the remembrance of the one woman who had given him his sense of a lose. It was from her that he inherited his detachment from the sumptuary side of life. The Stoic's carelessness of material things, combined with the Epicurean's pleasure in them. Life shorn of either feeling appeared to him a diminished thing, and nowhere was the blending of the two ingredients so essential as in the character of a pretty woman. It had always seemed to Selden that experience offered a great deal besides the sentimental adventure, yet he could vividly conceive of a love which should broaden and deepen till it became the central fact of life. What he could not accept, in his own case, was the makeshift alternative of a relation that should be less than this, that should leave some portions of his nature unsatisfied, while it put an undue strain on others. He would not, in other words, yield to the growth of an affection which might appeal to pity yet leave the understanding untouched. Sympathy should no more delude him than a trick of the eyes, the grace of helplessness than a curve of the cheek. But now that little, but passed like a sponge over all his vows. His reasoned out resistances seemed for the moment so much less important than the question as to when Lily would receive his note. He yielded himself to the charm of trivial preoccupations, wondering at what hour her reply would be sent, with what words it would begin. As to its import, he had no doubt he was as sure of her surrender as of his own. And so he had leisure to muse on all its exquisite details, as a hard worker, on a holiday morning, might lie still and watch the beam of light travel gradually across his room. But if the new light dazzled, it did not blind him. He could still discern the outline of facts, though his own relation to them had changed. He was no less conscious than before of what was said of Lily Bart, but he could separate the woman he knew from the vulgar estimate of her. His mind turned to Gerty Farish's words, and the wisdom of the world seemed a groping thing beside the insight of innocence. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God, even the hidden God in their neighbor's breast. Selden was in the state of impassioned self-absorption that the first surrender to love produces. His craving was for the companionship of one whose point of view should justify his own, who should confirm, by deliberate observation, the truth to which his intuitions had leaped. He could not wait for the midday recess, but seized a moment's leisure in court to scribble his telegram to Gerty Farish. Reaching town, he was driven direct to his club, where he hoped a note from Miss Bart might await him. But his box contained only a line of rapturous assent from Gerty, and he was turning away disappointed, when he was hailed by a voice from the smoking room. "Hello, Lawrence. Dining here? Take a bite with me, I've ordered a canvas back." He discovered Trina, in his day clothes, sitting, with a tall glass at his elbow, behind the folds of a sporting journal. Selden thanked him, but pleaded an engagement. "Hang it, I believe every man in town has an engagement tonight. I shall have the dub to myself. You know how I'm living this winter, rattling round in that empty house. My wife meant to come to town today, but she's put it off again, and how is a fellow to dine alone in a room with the looking glasses covered, and nothing but a bottle of Harvey sauce on the sideboard? I say, Lawrence, chuck your engagement and take pity on me. It gives me the blue devils to dine alone, and there's nobody but that canting ass Wetherill in the club. Sorry, Gus, I can't do it." As Selden turned away, he noticed the dark flush on Trina's face, the unpleasant moisture of his intensely white forehead, the way his jeweled rings were wedged in the creases of his fat red fingers. Certainly the beast was predominating the beast at the bottom of the glass. And he had heard this man's name coupled with Lily's. But the thought sickened him. All the way back to his rooms he was haunted by the sight of Trina's fat creased hands. On his table lay the note. Lily had sent it to his rooms. He knew what was in it. Before he broke the seal, a gray seal with beyond. Beneath a flying ship. Ah, he would take her beyond the ugliness, the pettiness, the attrition and corrosion of the soul. Gerty's little sitting room sparkled with welcome when Selden entered it. Its modest effects, compact of enamel paint and ingenuity, spoke to him in the language just then sweetest to his ear. It is surprising how little narrow walls and a low ceiling matter when the roof of the soul has suddenly been raised. Gerty sparkled too, or at least shone with a tempered radiance. He had never before noticed that as he had oints really, some good fellow might do worse. Over the little dinner and here, again, the effects were wonderful. He told her she ought to marry. He was in a mood to pair off the whole world. As he had made the caramel custard with her own hands, it was sinful to keep such gifts to herself. He reflected with a throb of pride that Lily could trim her own hats as he had told him, so the day of their walk at Bellomont. He did not speak of Lily till after dinner. During the little repast he kept the talk on his hostess, who, fluttered at being the center of observation, shone as rosy as the candle shades she had manufactured for the occasion. Selden evinced an extraordinary interest in her household arrangements. Complimented her on the ingenuity with which as he had utilized every inch of her small quarters, asked how her servant managed about afternoons out, learned that one may improvise delicious dinners in a chafing dish, and uttered thoughtful generalizations on the burden of a large establishment. When they were in the sitting room again, where they fitted as snugly as bits in a puzzle, and as he had brewed the coffee and poured it into her grandmother's eggshell cups, his eye, as he leaned back, basking in the warm fragrance, lighted on a recent photograph of Miss Bart, and the desired transition was effected without an effort. The photograph was well enough, but to catch her as he had looked last night. Journey agreed with him, never had she been so radiant. But could photography capture that light? There had been a new look in her face, something different. Yes, Selden agreed, there had been something different. The coffee was so exquisite that he asked for a second cup. Such a contrast to the watery stuff at the club. Ah, your poor bachelor with his impersonal club fare, alternating with the equally impersonal cuisine of the dinner party. A man who lived in lodgings missed the best part of life. He pictured the flavorless solitude of Trina's repast, and felt a moment's compassion for the man. But to return to Lily, and again he returned, questioning, conjecturing, leading Journey on, draining her inmost thoughts of their stored tenderness for her friend. At first she poured herself out unstintingly, happy in this perfect communion of their sympathies. His understanding of Lily helped to confirm her own belief in her friend. They dwelt together on the fact that Lily had had no chance. Journey instanced her generous impulses, her restlessness and discontent. The fact that her life had never satisfied her proved that she was made for better things. She might have married more than once the conventional rich marriage which S.E. had been taught to consider the sole end of existence, but when the opportunity came S.E. had always shrunk from it. Percy Grice, for instance, had been in love with her. Everyone at Bellomont had supposed them to be engaged, and her dismissal of him was thought inexplicable. This view of the Grice incident chimed too well with Selden's mood, not to be instantly adopted by him, with a flash of retrospective contempt for what had once seemed the obvious solution. If rejection there had been, and he wondered now that he had ever doubted it. Then he held the key to the secret, and the hillsides of Bellomont were lit up, not with sunset, but with dawn. It was he who had wavered, and disowned the face of opportunity, and the joy now warming his breast might have been a familiar inmate, if he had captured it in its first flight. It was at this point, perhaps, that a joy just trying its wings in Journey's heart dropped to earth and lay still. She sat facing Selden, repeating mechanically, colon, no, as he has never been understood, and all the while she herself seemed to be sitting in the center of a great glare of comprehension. The little confidential room, where a moment ago their thoughts had touched elbows like their chairs, grew to unfriendly vastness, separating her from Selden by all the length of her new vision of the future, and that future stretched out interminably, with her lonely figure toiling down it, a mere speck on the solitude. She is herself with a few people only, and you are one of them, she heard Selden saying. And again colon be good to her, Journey, won't you? And colon as he has it in her to become whatever she is believed to be, you'll help her, by believing the best of her? The words beat on Journey's brain like the sound of a language which has seemed familiar at a distance, but on approaching, is found to be unintelligible. He had come to talk to her of Lily, that was all. There had been a third at the feast as he had spread for him, and that third had taken her own place. She tried to follow what he was saying, to cling to her own part in the talk, but it was all as meaningless as the boom of waves in a drowning head, and she felt, as the drowning may feel, that to sing would be nothing beside the pain of struggling to keep up. Selden rose, and she drew a deep breath, feeling that soon she could yield to the blessed waves. Mrs. Fisher's? You say she was dining there? There's music afterward. I believe I had a card from her. He glanced at the foolish pink-faced clock that was drumming out this hideous hour. A quarter past 10? I might look in there now. The Fisher evenings are amusing. I haven't kept you up too late, Journey. You look tired. I've rambled on and bored you. And in the unwonted overflow of his feelings, he left a cousinly kiss upon her cheek. At Mrs. Fisher's, through the cigar smoke of the studio, a dozen voices greeted Selden. A psalm was pending as he entered, and he dropped into a seat near his hostess, his eyes roaming in search of Miss Bart. But she was not there, and the discovery gave him a pang out of all proportion to its seriousness, since the note in his breast pocket assured him that at 4 the next day they would meet. to his impatience it seemed immeasurably long to wait, and half ashamed of the impulse, he leaned to Mrs. Fisher to ask, as the music ceased, if Miss Bard had not dined with her. Lily? She's just gone. As he had to run off, I forget where. Wasn't she wonderful last night? Who's that? Lily? Asked Jack Stepney, from the depths of a neighboring armchair. Ah, really, you know, I'm no prude, but when it comes to a girl standing there, as if she was up at auction, I thought seriously of speaking to Cousin Julia. You didn't know Jack had become our social censor? Mrs. Fisher said to Selden with a laugh, and Stepney spluttered, amid the general derision, but she's a cousin, hang it, and when a man's married, town talk was full of her this morning. Yes. Lively reading that was, said Mr. Ned Van Alstyne, stroking his mustache to hide the smile behind it. Be by the dirty sheet? No, of course not. Some fellow showed it to me, but I'd heard the stories before. When a girl's as good-looking as that, she'd better marry, then no questions are asked. In our imperfectly organized society there is no provision as yet for the young woman who claims the privileges of marriage without assuming its obligations. Well, I understand Lily is about to assume them in the shape of Mr. Rosedale, Mrs. Fisher said with a laugh. Rosedale, good heavens! Exclaimed Van Alstyne, dropping his eyeglass. S. Stepney, that's your fault for foisting the brute on us. Oh, confound it, you know, we don't marry Rosedale in our family, Stepney languidly protested. But his wife, who sat in oppressive bridal finery at the other side of the room, quelled him with a judicial reflection, in Lily's circumstances it's a mistake, to have too high a standard. I hear even Rosedale has been scared by the talk lately, Mrs. Fisher rejoined. But the sight of her last night sent him off his head. What do you think he said to me after her tableau? My God, Mrs. Fisher, if I could get Paul Morpeth to paint her like that, the picture would appreciate 100% in 10 years. Apostrophe, by Jove, but isn't she about somewhere? Exclaimed Van Alstyne, restoring his glass with an uneasy glance. No, she ran off while you were all mixing the punch downstairs. Where was she going, by the way? What's on tonight? I hadn't. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.